Good to have you out again this evening. I invite you to take your Bibles. We're going to continue our survey of the Bible. And this time we're going to look at the book of Daniel, which is right after Ezekiel, which we talked about last time. Daniel is a contemporary of both Jeremiah and Ezekiel. We mentioned that before. Jeremiah is the older prophet. He remained in Judah during the captivity. Prophesied the captivity coming, remained in it, and died during the captivity, though he died down in Egypt, because he was taken against his will down there. Ezekiel was taken in the second wave of the captivity, spent his time among the captives in Babylonia. Daniel was also taken captive, but he was gone in the first wave, the first time Nebuchadnezzar came in and took over Israel. He took all the ruling class people. We'll talk about that basically why in a little bit. But that basically means that Daniel and the companions that we read about in the book of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, most of us remember them by their Babylonian names, they were all part of the upper class of Israel's society. Daniel himself comes from the tribe of Judah. And his name means, God is my judge. One of the interesting things about Daniel, if we look at it as a character, there's not too many characters in the Bible that you can name where God doesn't mention something that the person did wrong. Daniel's one of the few people that are actually, there's nothing recorded that he did wrong. In that he's mentioned three times in the book of Ezekiel. So there is verification that Daniel is a legitimate prophet. Take a look at Ezekiel chapter 14. Ezekiel chapter 14. And in verse 14. It says, even though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in its midst, by their own righteousness they could only deliver themselves, declares the Lord God. I find this fascinating. Daniel, the other two are famous people from history. Noah is somebody everybody knows. Job is a famous person. Daniel's living. He's a contemporary of Ezekiel. He's already made a reputation for himself that he is among the echelon of Bible characters. And God says, even if he was standing here, he wouldn't be able to save these people. Another mention like that is in the same chapter, verse 20. Even though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in his midst, as I live, declares the Lord God, they could not deliver their sons or their daughters. They could only deliver themselves by their righteousness. God's basically saying, if these three people were here, they were the only three people I would bother saving. And again in chapter 28 of Ezekiel, and in verse 3, it says, behold, you are wiser than Daniel. There is no secret that is a match for you. And that's being stated in sarcasm. It's mocking Pharaoh. Daniel already has a reputation for extreme wisdom. And he's basically mocking Pharaoh, saying, oh, you think you're smarter than Daniel is? And the answer is no, there isn't a person like Daniel that's alive at that time. Another passage that we need to go to is in Matthew 24. This is not the only mention in the New Testament. I do want to just mention at least one time where Jesus quotes from Daniel. In fact, he quotes Daniel chapter 9 and verse 27, a prophecy about the destruction of the, or desolation of the temple. And in Matthew 24 and verse 15, it says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which is spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Now, the reason why I want to point this out is there is pressure to say that Daniel is not a legitimate book of the Bible. The reason for it is because Daniel has so many prophecies. Of all the books, there are tons, literally hundreds of prophecies in Daniel that talk about historical events in detail. And a lot of people just cannot believe that somebody could write that much detail in advance. And so they're trying some other explanation for it. But we have both Ezekiel saying, well, Daniel is somebody who is existing, is righteous, is wise. We have Jesus quoting from the book of Daniel, calling it Daniel the prophet, testifying it there as well. These books are real. Now, going back to Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar's style of conquering countries was to take the youth of the countries and bring them into Babylonia, the ruling class, and basically retrain them. Actually, why he wants the youth is before they actually get trained in their own countries, train them in the Babylonian way of ruling. And then he would put those young people, after they'd gone through his training course, in charge of various aspects of the government, and basically by that hope that those countries would give Babylonia some loyalty because their people are in charge. But those people would be doing things the way Nebuchadnezzar wants them done. So in the book of Daniel, in chapter 1, excuse me, Daniel chapter 1, and starting with verse 4, said, youth in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving the king's court, he ordered them to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food, and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they each should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now, among them were the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned them new names to them. To Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, and Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and Azariah Abednego. So those are where their Babylonian names were. Now, we have to understand this. The city of, and I'll come back to Daniel 1 here in a moment, I have it listed here, but the city of Babylon was huge. We oftentimes, we think about these old cities and these old places. Yeah, they were kind of big, but we kind of tend to think of them more in size of towns. But here's the ruins of Babylon. This is a picture of it. This is one from 1932. As they first started digging it up. If you'll notice, they keep going and going and going. There's quite a few walls here of various towns and houses. This is a modern day. They've taken a section of it and they're starting to reconstruct it. So this is a 180-degree photograph, guy standing in the corner going this way and that way, composite. So it kind of warps it, but you get a somewhat of an idea of the size of it. You can see people right here. So you can kind of get a, and this is just one small section, the royal palace area of the Babylonia. Also, this is when they first started digging out, they did find like the gates of Babylon. This is the Ishtar Gate. Just to give you an idea of what Babylon might have looked like, it wasn't all mud and brick. You know, they had glazed tiles and tile work and stuff like that. And the city must have looked absolutely gorgeous. If you start thinking about how, just this is just one gate in the city. And this is an artist's reconstruction estimate of what one artist thought Babylon must have looked like. It had rivers flowing through it. They had the famous what was called the Hanging Gardens, which was one of the seven wonders of the world. Of course, there was a big tower that in it that is probably not the Tower of Babel, but one like it that was dominated the landscape. One Greek historian who lived 450 BC, Herodotus, said, in addition to its size, Babylon surpasses in splendor any city in the known world. Herodotus claimed that the outer walls were 56 miles in length. So if you went around the outer side, it'd take you 56 miles to get around. 80 feet thick, 320 feet tall. Wide enough, he said, to allow 2 four-horse chariots to pass each other on the top of the wall. The city also had inner walls, for which were not so thick as the first, but hardly less strong. Inside these double walls were fortresses and temples containing immense statues of solid gold. And that's what he said. Now, a lot of the modern archaeologists said, oh, the guy was exaggerating. I don't know. They're digging it up, but I don't know if they actually found the outer walls. Because Herodotus did mention that there were inner and outer walls. Because they did find some inner walls, and they're not quite so nearly as big and thick and impressive as what Herodotus is describing, but maybe they just haven't got that far out yet. We just don't know. But what we need to keep in mind is Babylon was a monstrous city with huge walls, absolutely gorgeous, decorated as one of the finest cities in the world. This is where Daniel took up residence as a youth. We don't know exactly when Daniel was taken into captivity, other than he just keeps describing him as being a youth when he went. He could have been 12, he could have been 16. We just don't know how old he was. But we do know that Daniel governed the entire 70 years of the Israelites' captivity. And during which time the Babylonian government then fell to the Medes and the Persians. And what's significant is that he continued to govern under the next set of kings. And I find that absolutely fascinating. Can you think of somebody who's so good at governing that one empire conquers another and they make one of the advisors rulers in the next empire? It's mentioned down in Daniel chapter 1 and verse 21. It says, and Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. It's because of this particular comment that most people agree that Daniel was probably written towards the end of Daniel's life. Because here at the beginning of the book, he mentions something that happens towards the end of his life. Now, as far as the book and its organization goes, there's different ways you can look at it. One of the odd things about Daniel is it's written in two different languages. Chapter 1 is written in Hebrew. Chapters 2 through 7 are written in Aramaic. And then chapters 8 through 12 are written again in Hebrew. So one way we can divide up the book is by the languages which are being used. Another way to look at the book is divided by its point of view. Daniel chapter 1 up to chapter 7 verse 1 is all written in the third person. But starting with Daniel 7 verse 2 is all written in the first person. It uses I. And Daniel talks about his direct experiences. Another way you can divide the book is by the style. Most of the young people probably remember most of the stories from Daniel's chapters 1 through 6. There's a lot of action in there. The first six books are historical accounts. And there's a lot of action, a lot of miracles, there's a lot of exciting things that go on. Daniel 7 through 12 are prophecies. They're visions of the future. And that's the little tougher things to get through and wade through as far as trying to understand what it's talking about. Now, Daniel has been picked on, like I said, as being a fraudulent book. And most people want to place the dating of his writings to the end of the Maccabees, which is just a little bit before, about 150 years before Christ. And like I said, the reason for it is there's so many prophecies in Daniel that are accurate in minute detail. But they actually, if you think about it, the argument is completely backwards. Because it assumes that no book can be accurate in prophecy. It's not a proof. It just starts out with an assumption. There is no way that somebody could prophesy this well, so therefore it can't be done that way. That's not a proof. That's an assumption. Now the other argument is because of the language. The use of Aramaic that's in that book also has some Persian terms and some Greek terms. And they say, okay, wait. This is not pure. Well, the Aramaic, actually, people have analyzed it. They've gone through it. They looked at it. And it's not your typical Aramaic, as in Daniel. It's actually in a very early form of what they call imperial Aramaic, is what the royal class would speak. Well, guess what? That's exactly what you would expect somebody from Babylon, who was schooled in Babylon, to speak. Would be the official governmental, the royal version, the noble class version of Aramaic, because Aramaic was the language of Babylon. Persian, well, you expect Persian words. Daniel wrote Daniel towards the end of his life, and he did it under the Persian government. You expect some Persian words to be used. And the Persian Empire, by the way, was expanding and was known to people even before they actually started taking conquering. So you expect that as well. Greek words, actually the only Greek words that are in there that they make such a big deal about is some musical instruments. Remember when there's an idol that they're supposed to fall down and worship, and they're playing all sorts of instruments? A couple of them have the Greek names for the instruments. Well, that only tells me where it came from. You imported an instrument from another country, you probably call it by that country's name. That's not all that unexpected. Actually, in reality, if it was true that it was during the Maccabees era, the Maccabees lived when Greece had conquered that region. If it really was Greece, it was written later, you expect a lot of Greek words to infiltrate the language. Because Greek was the dominant empire at that time. You only get a couple of musical instruments is all you have. So it's the lack of Greek words, actually, that argue for an earlier date. There's other ways we can talk about it as well, but there's sufficient proof, let's put it that way, to say that Daniel was really written by Daniel at the time of which it was claimed to be. Now, there's two ways to divide Daniel. Like I said, by the language, showing who's being addressed. And when you go by language, then what you see is that the first part is a personal account of how he got there. And says, with a young lad, it was appropriate to talk in Hebrew. It's telling the Jews how he got there. Actually, the book from chapters 2 through 7 are mostly prophecies and things like that that were given to Nebuchadnezzar or to Belteshazzar or to Cyrus. You would expect it to be in the language of whom these events took place in. And so it's in Aramaic. The last set of chapters, 8 through 12, deal with prophecies that are given to Israel. Daniel actually, in a prayer in chapter 9, asked God, what's going to happen to Israel? God actually answers that in detail. Well, who's interested in this particular history? The Jews are. So Daniel wrote it in Hebrew. And so that explains the division of the language. Or we can do it by style. A lot of people divide it by style. Again, by the history for the first 6 chapters and by the visions for the last 7 chapters. I'm going to use by the language and show the division that way. But it really doesn't make any much difference as far as understanding the book. Chapter 1 is about Daniel's background. We already noted in chapter 1, verse 5, it says, "The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food, from among the wines which he drank, and he appointed them that they should be educated 3 years, of which they were to enter into the king's personal service." So they had 3 years of training to go through. So basically, if you think about it, if he got there when he was 12, he would be done with the training by 15. He got there at 16, which most people kind of lean towards. Then by 19, he would be ready to go serve in the government. So somewhere in that time frame, as far as the age goes. What we find is right at the very beginning, Daniel establishes his loyalty to God. Starting in verse 8 of that chapter, it says, "But Daniel made up his mind that he should not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine with which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to David, 'I'm afraid, my lord, the king, who had appointed your food and your drink, for why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king.' But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, 'Please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. And then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see.'" So Daniel proposed a test. But we find what we start seeing the character of Daniel. How many young people who are taken into captivity, going into a foreign country, would be bold enough to say, "I'm going to stick to following what God's will," and be able to reason with adults and say, "Hey, here's a good way we can test this out so you don't get in trouble." We already see Daniel sticking up for God and also some of the wisdom that God granted to them. What we see at the end, it says, "So he listened to them in this manner and tested them for 10 days, and at the end of the 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were drinking, kept giving them vegetables. And as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of vision and dreams. And when at the end of the days the king had specified for presenting them, this commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and out of all of them, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king." Again, we see God's hand in all this happening. Now, one of the things that does cause a little bit of confusion is Daniel was taken in Nebuchadnezzar's first year reign. Now, there's a question of whether this was first year when Nebuchadnezzar reigned on his own. There was a little overlap between Nebuchadnezzar's personal reign and the next reign, where his father actually dies. Towards the end, he took over just before his father died. So there was a little bit of confusion possibly about that. Or what we have to understand is the second chapter of Daniel actually takes place during those 3 years of training. Because the second chapter of Daniel begins by telling us it is the first or second year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And so if we understand that Daniel chapter 1 starts with the first year, and it's supposed to be 3 years of training, Daniel's chapter 2 is actually, you got to insert it into Daniel chapter 1. And in this dream, it says, that there was a dream about a statue that had different parts made out of different material. So he's still quite young. He hasn't finished his official training. But in that vision, we won't go through all the details of it. That vision is a prediction of four great kingdoms, with Babylon being the first, the head of gold. And the king is told that he was given this kingdom. In Daniel chapter 2, starting with verse 37, actually, I'm going to start with verse 36. This was a dream which we will tell you its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom and the power, the strength and the glory. And where the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. Now think about this. Let's say Daniel did get there when he was 16. So he's 17, because it's his second year. He's still in training. But he was presented. That's one of the reasons why he didn't come immediately. And didn't hear about it until later, if you read through the story. But he's still in training, but he does hear about it. He talks himself into being able to talk to the king about it. He's a 17-year-old youth, and he says, oh, by the way, king, you're the head of gold. God gave you this kingdom. You didn't earn this. This is not by your might. God gave it to you and granted you the right to rule this. But that's a point that we need to keep in mind, because this is really what the book of Daniel is about. Nebuchadnezzar was very impressed with Daniel, because one of the challenges that Nebuchadnezzar did when he had that dream is he refused to tell anybody what his dream was. He insisted that they explain it to him first. Daniel was able to do that. And so, in verse 47, it says, the king answered Daniel and said, surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him great many gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief perfect over the wise men of Babylon. And this is where Daniel starts having problems. Because if you do understand that Daniel is probably 17 years old, hasn't even finished his training courses yet, and now he's put in charge of everybody. He's in charge of his own teachers, as well as people who have been in the government for ages. This does not go over very well with other people. So either the appointment's taken place after the 3 years of training, then he appointed them, we don't know, or the 3 years were cut short, again, we don't know. Chapter 1 makes it sound like the 3 years did get to completion. So somehow we can fit those together. Shadrach and the Meshach and Abednego are talked about in chapter 3. This is the famous story about the fiery furnace. Everybody remembers that. There was an idol that was put up. There were musical instruments that were played. Everybody was supposed to bow down to this idol. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused. Daniel's not mentioned, probably because he was elsewhere at the time. The time of this event is not mentioned, so we don't know how long into the Nebuchadnezzar's reign has occurred. What it does do is cause resentment. Again, remember, Daniel and his friends all got promoted. In fact, we didn't read verse 49 in chapter 2. And Daniel made requests of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. So when Daniel got promoted, he made his three friends his advisors. And they were his sub-rulers underneath him. Didn't go over well. And so when these three refused to bow, you can just see people saying, we know what the politics are like around our country. I'm sure they were a little more brutal in their country. But here is people said, oh, we got a chance to trap these men, or young men. However, like I said, we don't know exactly how long this took place later. What we see, though, is a demonstration of great courage and faith again. Despite knowing it would cause their lives, in chapter 3 and verse 15, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answer the king and say, now, if you're ready, the king says this, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the tarragon, the psaltery, and the bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will be immediately cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire, and what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? And there's again a key verse. The question is, who's in charge? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king of Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. Now, remember, the king put them basically in the second tier over the entire government. They ought to feel very strongly that the king's been very nice and generous to them. And they said, basically, we don't care. You don't have to test us. We'll give you the answer right now. We're not doing it. We're not going to bow to your idols. We're not going to bow to your gods. And the king already said it. You know, what God can possibly deliver you out of my hand? He was furious with the answer. Did not like it. Throws them into a fiery furnace. They are amazingly saved. They come out totally unscathed, despite the fact that the people who threw them in died just getting that close to the furnace. They not only come out, but they don't even smell of smoke. There's not a hair singed on them. They don't smell smoke. And Nebuchadnezzar also hadn't seen a fourth person who doesn't come out of the furnace. So he can't figure out what the fourth person is, other than it looks like an angelic type person. That's all we're mentioned of it. But at the result of that, and we got to remember, Nebuchadnezzar is the one who destroyed Israel, wiped out the temple. And from Nebuchadnezzar's point of view, he wiped out Israel's God. But notice in Daniel chapter 3 and verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. That's quite a testimony. Nebuchadnezzar is so impressed. He said, there is no other God that could possibly do this. No one's going to be allowed to say anything bad about it. He'll personally tear him limb from limb, or order it personally. Then we get to chapter 4. And this is the famous one where he has a dream that Daniel interprets for him that basically says, you're going to get to a point where God's going to make you insane for 7 years. What's interesting about this is a very unique chapter in the Bible because it's written by Nebuchadnezzar. It's recorded in Daniel, but it's Nebuchadnezzar's writing of what happened to him. It's written from Nebuchadnezzar's point of view. Nebuchadnezzar does say that he lost his sanity as prophesied by Daniel for 7 years. And at the end, the king then gives his testimony yet once again. Because it happened that when it happened was when Nebuchadnezzar declared, I'm going to look at this great kingdom I built. And here's the point that comes up in chapter 4, verse 34. At the end of this period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyebrows toward heaven, eyes towards heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I bless the Most High and praise and honor him who lives forever. Notice he's now calling God the Most High. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of earth are counted as nothing. He does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth. No one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? And at the time of my reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor were restored to me for my kingdom, for the glory of my kingdom. And my counselors and my nobles began to seek me out, so I reestablished my sovereignty. Surpassing greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, honor the King of heaven, for all his works are true, his ways are just, and he's able to humble those who walk in pride. And he's talking about himself. The next chapter is about Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, Belteshazzar. When Nebuchadnezzar died, there was a big turmoil over who was going to be the next leader. They went through about four leaders real fast. And the one who was leading really was not in the direct succession from Nebuchadnezzar. And the one who's on the in Babylon is actually, he's not the ruler of the Babylonian Empire. He's second in command. He's the prince of the Babylonian Empire, which explains one of the statements is in chapter 5. But this one is the one that we know about, the handwriting on the wall. So this one takes place at the fall of Babylon. There's 66 years into captivity. Daniel by now is an old man. Even if you say, okay, he was captured when he was 12 or 16, you know, you're talking about he's in his late 70s or early 80s at this point. He's an old man. We see here also the moral decadence of Babylon's leaders had fallen into. Because what we find out from the story is the Persian Empire has an army camp outside of Babylon. Now, yes, it's a great big massive city with huge walls, but there's an army on the outskirts of the city. And what is the king or the prince of Babylon doing? He's partying and getting drunk. Daniel, in that event, there was handwriting that appears on the wall. They saw the hand writing it. They call for Daniel because he's the one known to be able to interpret. And Daniel foretells Belshazzar's kingdom was going to fall. But again, the king rewards Daniel. Daniel says, I don't want it. You're not going to last that long anyway. And that night, Belshazzar dies in the battle that ensues. And basically, Babylon's taken over very peacefully. Daniel, one of the interesting points that's in Daniel 5 is there wasn't a huge ruckus when they changed governments. That shows you how much the people despised the people that were currently governing them at the time. But they actually welcomed the Persians when they conquered them. Daniel chapter 6 is the famous story about Daniel being in the lion's den. Most of your children's drawings are all wrong, because they throw Daniel as a young man being thrown into the lion's den. Daniel at this time, this one's taking place after the Medes take over. So Daniel would be probably in his late 80s or early 90s at the time this one's taking place. Darius the Mede was king over Babylon under the Emperor Cyrus the Persian. The cause again for the attack was because of jealousy of Daniel's position. People just didn't like this fact. Hey, you know, even though he's an old man, a lot of people didn't like the fact that here was a guy who was ruling under the conquered kingdom, and now he's put in charge? And they just didn't like that. Also tells you Daniel's capabilities. That he can rule over Babylon and then rule over the Persian Empire of Babylon. He must have been a really good linguist, too. Be able to speak all these different languages. Again, we find that Darius is favorable to Daniel. But I want you to notice Darius's impression of God in Daniel chapter 6, verse 25. Then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, the nations, and men of every language who are living in all the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. His dominion will be forever, and he delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So thus Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now, it's not two kings, one after the other. Darius is actually a ruler, that's a sub-ruler underneath of Cyrus. But again, notice that impression that each one of these miracles do. How people are impressed that God reigns. God is sovereign. Now, when we get to chapter 8, we have several prophecies. There's a focus in chapter 8 on a vision of the ram and a goat. Those visions are a prophecy about the Persian and the Greek empires. We're going to look at Daniel chapter 8, verse 19. He said, "Behold, I am going to let you know what will occur in the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. The ram which you saw are the two horns, which represents the kings of Media and Persia, and the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, with the large horn that's between his eyes, as is his first king. The broken horn and the four horns that arose in his place represent four kingdoms which arise from his nation, although not with his power." Now I want you to notice what it just stated. We're at the beginning of the Persian Empire taking over the world. And Daniel is just given a vision and says, okay, then now the next one that's going to conquer is the Greeks. Say, oh yeah, lucky guess. Okay, it's going to be conquered by one strong king who will then lose his power, be replaced by four kings, each of which who can never rule quite as strongly as the one king. And it's exactly what happened with Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great conquered so much world, he was disappointed when he did it in his 20s, by the way, conquered most of the world, even all the way up to India. He was crying for the fact that he didn't have any place else left to conquer, and he didn't die. But his generals take over, and he split his kingdom four ways. But none of them could ever quite match what Alexander did. One of the later kings, which is mentioned in this prophecy, because it talks about a small horn that comes off of one of the horns, most think is Anacostus Epiphanes. He tried to force the Greek beliefs throughout his kingdom, and he had the area that occupied Israel. He even put an idol in the temple of God, and forbade the Jews from circumcising their children or worshiping on the Sabbath, and he tried to force it in there. What's interesting is the exact time for the desolation is given. In Daniel chapter 8, verse 13, it says, "Then I heard the Holy One speaking, and another Holy One said to that particular one who was speaking, 'How long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the holy to be trampled?' He said to me, 'For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored.'" Later on, you find out that it mentions this is an exact time. This is not a representative time. 2,300 days. That's 6 years. Guess what? That's about how long this guy tried to force Greek religion on the Jews. It was approximately 6 years. Daniel tells in advance exactly how long, how many days it's going to be in advance. Then Daniel chapter 9, we talked about this in the another lesson about the vision of the 70 weeks. It tells you exactly how many days from the restoration to the coming of Christ. How many years? Precisely. And he tells about, for instance, that the Messiah would be minister for 3.5 years and then die. It's all stated here in Daniel. In chapter 10, there's a visitation of an angel. Fascinating. They're called princes here. But it's talking about angels. And we're told that the angels are behind the nations and at war with each other between the good and the bad angels. And basically what chapter 9 is a warning to say that all's not what it appears to be from our earthly viewpoint. What we think is happening and what's actually happening might be two different things. And that's what we get from Daniel chapter 10. Daniel chapter 11 and 12 actually covers, again, as an answer to Daniel's question in chapter 9. He wants to know what's going to happen. And chapters 11 and 12 focus on the Greek Empire leading up to the time of Christ. It gives all sorts of intricate detail. It's hard to follow because it talks about the king of the north, the king of the south, because remember the kingdom got split in a bunch of different ways. And it's hard to interpret because it covers the years of silence. The reason why it's hard to interpret is because we don't have God saying, oh, this is what Daniel meant when he said this. Because God wasn't talking to anybody at that time. So we have to look at what Daniel says, try finding those events in history, and what Daniel's or God mentions in Daniel as being significant may not necessarily be what the historians thought were significant. So there are gaps in our historical knowledge. But there's a lot of things that's easily matched up. Enough to say, wait a minute, this is incredible. How many things that Daniel even talks about, you know, one of the daughters and how she gets treated by her father and tried to get married off to the other king to make peace. And in fact, she didn't look all that great. I mean, a whole bunch of details they're finding in this chapter. It's also a period of great upheavals. We only know the broad events. We don't know all the fine details. What you do find is a lot of people hijacking these verses for modern events. But you got to remember, Daniel asked God, what's going to happen to the Jews next? And this is the answer. They're basically, what he was told is they're going to be caught between two kingdoms and their power struggles. And that's really what happened to Israel. They were played like a tennis ball between two players. Bounced back, forth, bounced back. And it seemed like they were never in any one particular kingdom very long before somebody else conquered them. And this is talking about that period of time. And Daniel gives it very precisely and very accurately. What we should walk away from the book of Daniel is Daniel is about God's sovereignty. The fact that God reigns, that he controls the kingdoms, that people who think they're doing so great and control so much really have no clues to what's going on. God has control. And the book of Daniel proves God's control by all the detailed prophecies that say, here's what the future is going to be like. There is no man who could give that much detail about the future. Because if you think about it, Daniel, like 11 and 12, covers 600 years of history and gives all sorts of interesting details about those historical events way in advance. I can't even tell you who's going to rule in 600 years, let alone tell you start details about how those things happen. But that's what Daniel is about. I hope you'll think about these things, appreciate what it is, the significance of the book, and the impact it has on our knowledge about God's inspiration, as well as God's power. We'd like to offer an opportunity. If there's anyone here tonight who's not yet a child of God, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ. If there's anyone here who is a child of God, we'd like to pray as a brethren on your behalf. Why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song of selection.